This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, Frost and Sullivan Malaysia's mobile data service provider of the year.
Good morning, I'm Melissa Idris, and today on The Breakfast Grill, I'm speaking to Fuzia Saleh, Deputy Minister in the Prime Minister's Department in charge of Religious Affairs. She's also been the PKR Member of Parliament for the seat of Kuantan since 2008 and has also been the Vice President of PKR since 2010. Welcome to The Breakfast Grill. It's lovely to have you here.
It's my pleasure, Melissa. Thank you very much.
So before I begin, I'd like to just quickly mention our WhatsApp number. It's 018-789-8899 and our Twitter handle is at BFM Radio. So please send your questions if you would like me to pose them to the Deputy Minister over the next 45 minutes. I'd like to begin with a look at the role of a minister in the Prime Minister's Department in charge of Religious Affairs. If you could spell out for us what falls under that purview.
Basically, there's about 14 agencies under us. The main one is, of course, JAKIM that people know. And JAKIM itself have various departments. JAKIM looks after mosque, look after Kafa, the Class Al-Quran and Fardu Ain. It looks after Tahfiz schools. It looks after the Imam and various other activities. That's JAKIM.
So everything that JAKIM looks after, you have to look after as well?
Yes, yes. And there's also other agencies like YADIM, which is Yayasan Dakwah Islam Malaysia. There's also YAPIM, Yayasan Ekonomi Islam Malaysia. There's Tabung Haji. We look after the Hajj programs specifically, not the investments. Now the investments is directly under the Prime Minister. IKIM.
That's the Institute Kemajuan Islam, right?
Yes, Institute Kemajuan Islam. And then we have TV Hijrah.
Mm-hmm. So can you explain to me the differences or the unique selling propositions of each of these agencies? Is there no overlap?
Okay, I've been here just a bit over 2.5 months.
Still trying to.
I'm still trying
learn
to.
The ropes.
But my initial assessment of the situation is that there are overlaps, there are redundancies, and the culture before this is to work in silos. And this is what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to make sure that they leverage on each other, that there is collaborations, and that we should not duplicate our work and not overlaps. Another thing that I observe is that there is no one focal point. We don't have a focal point. In other ministries, there is the KSU, who has everything at his fingertips or her fingertips. Mm-hmm. But I have no one focal point. So when I come in, I have to find my way through. They don't work across agencies. So we have to directly search for what we're looking for. Sometimes it takes me 3 days in initial days to actually find out what I'm looking for.
So how do you plan to break down those silos?
We have started to work as a team. And we are looking into there are various platforms that we have roundtables, discussions. We're going to have a retreat.
Are you looking at appointing a one focal point?
This is also another proposal that we're going to bring to this Jawatan Kuasa Tertinggi that has been set up under Tun Ahmad Sarji. I hope that he observed that there is no one focal point. I've also mentioned it to him that there is no one focal point. I hope that he puts it into his consideration to consider a focal point for all these 14 agencies. Otherwise, I have to do the work of KSU as well as Deputy Minister.
So 14 agencies, what would you say is your top priority at the moment?
The top priorities, initially it has been firefighting because there are a lot of issues that we have to resolve. There are some board of directors that have not met for months because it was chaired by the previous minister who has not resigned but who has not also come to office. So we have to deal with a lot of firefighting in the beginning. But now I am focusing on more agenda setting. The way forward. For example, I'm
what
looking...
What is your agenda?
For example, for the past few weeks, I've been looking at our Kafa, our Class Agama, Al-Quran and Fardu Ain, all over the countries, which involve about 32,000 plus teachers that are now on contract. They are running our classes for our children, and but yet they are not into the scheme for proper scheme for their positions as teachers. So I'm looking into that. I'm looking into their trainings and I'm looking into their qualifications. So we're bridging the gap and we're trying to do something progressive with regards to their positions.
So it's been 2.5 months. So we'll give you some time to, I guess, feel your way around the 14 agencies.
Yeah, but I'm also planning something, Melissa. I'm planning to set a benchmarking practice, a best practice of Islamic management. And we hope to have something like the SDGs for Islamic institutions, management of Islamic institutions. Like, do we have green mosque? Or, for example, what is the best practice to manage your zakat? Or what is the best practice to manage your wakaf? And
okay,
so
really focusing on advancing
yes.
the practice of Islam as opposed to punishing offences against Islam.
I think we have to steer away from that perception that Islam is actually very progressive, and actually Islam encompasses all.
You've used that word a couple of times in the first 10 minutes of this conversation. How would you define and characterize liberal and progressive Muslims in this country?
Liberal in the context of international definition is different from liberal in the Malaysian context.
Yes. How would you define liberal and progressive?
Malaysian have this perception that liberal is loose and free for all, and that's dangerous for us. Whereas liberal in the international context means that we respect human rights. We give room for everyone to have a space, but then that's not acceptable. The word liberal is not acceptable in Malaysia. So I prefer to use the word progressive, because Islam is progressive, and Islam and respect other religions, while at the same time our constitution uphold the rights of the Muslim and Islam as the religion of the state.
And I think I'd also like to touch on the legislation, right? So the legal framework that makes this, I guess, difficult for many in the past few events that we've seen, especially with the caning of the two women in Terengganu. I think it all boils down to the idea that Islamic matters is a state purview, but policy is formed at a federal level. So how do you separate your jurisdiction, with you being the minister, deputy minister in charge of religious affairs under the Prime Minister's Department, how do you separate your jurisdiction with that of the state?
The jurisdiction of the state is totally under the state, and they answer directly to the Sultan of the state. However, there is also this buying in, which I think previously it was not something that was practiced. I believe in that. I believe in dialogues. I believe in selling ideas. For example, we need to ensure that the enactments are the same across the states. For example, if we don't have the same enactments and we don't have the same, we don't use the same system, if a man wants to marry a second time and he crosses another state, then there is no system that tracks whether he's married or not. So it does work to the advantage to have a common system and a common law
across the states.
So you're
talking about the different laws relating to Sharia among the different states. This is not even the state versus federal conversation. We're having different laws at different states.
Yes, there are. The fine tunings are different.
I see. Okay, so are there efforts being made to fine tune this to make sure that it's standardized?
I'm meeting the I'm chairing the meeting for the head of the Jabatan Agama Islam Negeri this weekend, and I hope that we can resolve some matters with regards to standardizing the enactments across the states.
Is there any effort being made to harmonizing Sharia and civil laws, making state laws more consistent with federal legislation?
That is the second stage. I mean, we have to harmonize the enactments across the state first. But there are specific areas that we have to look into, and we have to make sure that the Sharia law and the civil law does not overlap, so that there are no areas which becomes tricky, for example. So we have to make sure that it does not overlap.
So you've been quoted as saying that the poor application of the law by the Sharia courts is causing religious tension. I'd like to give you an opportunity for you to elaborate what you mean by that.
Okay, let's look at transgender. Across the states, there are different enactments. People are blaming us for not being strict with transgender. But the law itself does not state that it is wrong or it is against the law for a man to be dressed as a woman. And then it is about implementation. So, and then they put the blame on the federal. I give you another example, which is easier to understand perhaps, with regards to Tahfiz schools. We do not have a law that forces or make it compulsory for a Tahfiz school to register. And when they don't register with the Jabatan Agama Islam Negeri, what happens is that they get away with all the safety requirements. And then they also get away with collecting, they do their fundraising without permission. So this is with regards to enforcement. And we're not able to implement this because of the law itself. So and then the law again then falls back to the states. So this is the difficulties that we are facing.
I'm speaking to Fuzia Saleh, Deputy Minister in the Prime Minister's Department in charge of religious affairs. We're going to continue our conversation in just a few minutes. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
I'm speaking to Fuzia Saleh, the Deputy Minister in the Prime Minister's Department in charge of religious affairs. Thank you for staying with the Breakfast Grill. Now, you can get in touch with us. Our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Lots to cover in the next 15 minutes or so. We have LGBT, transgender and Jakim as well to cover. So let me see whether I can do that. Deputy Minister, you and your minister, Datuk Mujahid Rawa, have consistently repeated calls not to distort statements or to misinterpret the government's approach to LGBT. Mm. Can you set the record straight, please? Now, in your own words, how should we interpret how the Pakatan Harapan government plans to approach LGBT rights?
Okay, with any groups or that is considered as marginalized, with certain issues to deal with, that is always the approach of making sure that it doesn't happen, preventive. And that is also the approach of development or rehabilitation.
Okay, so how has it been misinterpreted? Help me understand the misconception.
So when we talk about preventive, we're talking about laws. For example, with the case of transgender, preventive means there must be laws that prevent them from behaving in such a manner in public. At the moment, our laws are not consistent. The enactments in the various states say that there is no law which says that the action can be taken against them if they dress as a woman. Most of the enactments say that they must prove that they are doing something which is immoral before action can be taken against them. Meaning that preventive-wise, it is difficult to prevent such an act. So, I mean, how can the public blame us when all this while the enactments and the various laws in the state does not actually prevent that from happening? There's also the rehabilitation, where we want to help them. I would like to bring to your attention, Melissa, that more than 80% of transgender are sex workers. They are working in the streets. We want to assist them to bring them out of the streets. We want to propose career change programs for them. It is the attitude of the society that pushes them further into the streets.
So let me get this right. The rehabilitation program run by JAKIM is only for transgender?
Okay, if we look at LGBT, lesbians are difficult to identify because they don't announce it, unless except for the case in Terengganu. Because people don't normally announce that or announce to the public, admit that they are lesbian. Same with gay or bisexual. The only group that is openly declaring that they are transgender is this group of Matnya, that they call themselves as Matnya. But it's not just about dressing alone, Melissa. It's about them being sex workers. More than 80% are in the streets. This is our concern. And they actually do want to go through career change program. They want to get out of the streets. But the society does not allow them to do that. The society pushes them further. This society prefers to judge them. What we are doing is that we are bringing them out. By bringing them out of the streets, by offering them career change programs, by offering them skills and duit zakat even to assist them, it doesn't mean that we are condoning what they're doing. It means that we are doing da'wah to them. I mean, this is the wrong perception that the public have about us. Then they think we are condoning and they judge us. And
Could you explain? So are you saying that there are some members of the public who think that the Pakatan Harapan government is condoning LGBT?
Oh, there's a big segment of the public that says that. You should see the social media, how we are being attacked with regards to this LGBT issue.
I have to respectfully disagree because I think there are people within the LGBT community who say that the Pakatan Harapan government has not done enough for them.
All right, there's such a wide spectrum, Melissa, and we are trying to do as much as we can because there's so many marginalized groups. LGBT is not just one of them. I am now trying to find about the best technique to do kafa teachings to disabled children. That's also another challenge because normally even the disabled children, they don't have this opportunity to learn about the Al-Quran, and parents are asking me to do that as well. Mm. So there's so much to do.
And I understand where you're coming from. I understand the complexities of addressing these issues in the public space, especially in the context of a Muslim majority society. But you can't please everyone. But the question is, at what political cost? So where does the Pakatan Harapan government stand when it comes to LGBT rights?
When it comes to LGBT rights, we have this approach of Rahmatan Lil Alamin because Islam is rahmat to all, is a blessing to all. So we should not be judgmental in our approach, and we should always approach to seek understanding and to assist and to look upon them with care, because if we judge them, we will push them to a corner and we will not be able to help them. That's our position.
Can I ask you what lessons you've learned in terms of communication on these issues or sometimes miscommunication, if I might?
The lesson I learned is that media like to sensationalize things, and sometimes small issues are blown out of proportions, and sometimes it's best not to respond to certain issues. However, I do believe in communication, and I do believe in correcting whatever misperceptions there are.
Well, I hope you address some of the questions that we've had coming in from listeners. Now, Mohan Ramakrishnan is asking, good morning, Deputy Minister. What is the PMO's stand on underage girls who are married off? Two such cases have surfaced and the trend is worrying.
Oh, with regards to child marriage, thank you, Mohan. With regards to child marriage, we are committed to support the move to raise the age, minimum age to 18, because previously, the minimum age under the Sharia law is 16 for girls and 18 for boys. The civil law is the same, is 16 for girls and 18 for boys. Now, we are committed to support the move by the Minister of Women to raise the age or the minimum age for girls to 18. However, that does not solve the problem for child marriage, because people who wants to marry will still wants to marry. And the procedure before this, for the Sharia court, they have got to seek permission from the Sharia judge, Hakim Sharia. And for the civil, for the non-Muslims, they have to get the permission from the MB, the Menteri Besar, or the minister, chief minister. This procedure In the past, for the Muslims, it is not so strict. However, we have introduced an SOP, a guideline, a very strict procedure that puts the welfare of the child as a central issue. So that procedure is supposed to protect the well-being of the child. For example, if an undermarried girl asks for permission to marry, there will be many interviews, many tests, amongst it like reproductive health test, psychological test. We even interviewed the parents so that the poverty should not be a reason for marriage, even if pregnancy should also not be an excuse to marry off your daughter. For example, if the daughter is raped, sometimes they ask for permission to marry off their daughters.
So
it shouldn't be an excuse.
So this is coming from the parents? So are the parents the ones who approach you to marry off
both,
their daughter?
Both parents, both the parent as well as the child will have to ask for permission. And according to the new procedures that have already been presented to all of the Ketua Hakim Mahkamah Syariah Negeri-Negeri, this SOP should be implemented. But not every state have adopted it.
So these are just guidelines, right?
Yes.
They're not part of legislation. And
not
yet. Help me understand again the overlap here, because I believe this is under the purview of the Women's Ministry. Is it under the Prime Minister's Department in charge of religious affairs? At the federal level?
At the federal level, for the civil law, it's under the purview of the Women Minister.
This is how it gets convoluted, right?
Very.
And this is how I think sometimes cases fall through the cracks.
Correct. I agree with you there. Because the Sharia court falls under the Prime Minister's department. The civil law is under the Women Minister. So the right of the welfare of the child, technically, if you ask me, who's responsible? Actually, both of us are responsible, the Women Minister as well as we at the Prime Minister's Department with regards to the enactments in the states.
Okay, well, I do want to give some time before we head into the 8:30 news bulletin to very quickly talk about JAKIM. So talk to me about how JAKIM, and it was reported in June that Islamic agencies under the Prime Minister's Department will be restructured. What updates do you have for us of the review of JAKIM's role and administration?
At the moment, JAKIM is still under the Prime Minister's Department plus all the other agencies. There is now a review by Tun Ahmad Sarji's committee, which is the highest committee. We are waiting for their feedback. They will take till the end of the year to complete their review. However, we are going on as usual because JAKIM is still under us.
So right now, there's no change to JAKIM's mandate?
No.
Which is?
Which is JAKIM is still under the Prime Minister's Department, specifically Minister of Religious Affairs.
The other issue that was devoted to JAKIM was the size of its budget, right? So are you expecting the budget allocation for JAKIM for 2019 to be higher than the current 810 million ringgit, which they received this year?
I would like to bring to your attention, Melissa, that half of that budget is for the to pay the contract workers for CAFA teachers. It is not all for the administration of JAKIM. And so it is not that high when you understand that, you know, it is to pay the CAFA teachers. But once we put the CAFA teachers under the Pejawatan scheme, then maybe we can put them their emolument elsewhere. So JAKIM's budget will not look over bloated.
I'm speaking to Fuzia Saleh, Deputy Minister in the Prime Minister's Department in charge of religious affairs. She's also the PKR Member of Parliament for the seat of Kuantan since 2008. And after the 8:30 News Bulletin, we're going to come back and talk to her about Chinese investments in her constituency. Stay tuned to The Breakfast Grill, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to The BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Thanks for staying with this special extended version of The Breakfast Grill. I'm Melissa Idris, and on the show today, the Deputy Minister in the Prime Minister's Department in charge of religious affairs, Fuzia Saleh. I'm going to leave the religious affairs portfolio for now, but I also want to note that you are the PKR Member of Parliament for the seat of Kuantan, and you have been so since 2008, during which you spearheaded the Stop Linus Rare Earth Refinery campaign over concerns of having the risk of having Lynas Advanced Materials plant near Kuantan.
Yes.
So tell me, is there updates on the Lynas front?
Since Pakatan Harapan government came in, we have been trying to revisit the Lynas issue. And I would just like to inform you that YBU, Bien, who is the minister in charge, she has already set up the review panel and she has appointed me to head that review panel. So we will start work immediately next week.
One of the biggest concerns in Kuantan, so Lynas aside, has been the issue of or the scale of China's investments in the state. Can you share with us the scale of such investments?
It is a huge investment. And at the moment, we have Alliance Steel, which is the first investor in MCKIP, Malaysia China Kuantan Industrial Park, and which is supposed to be a twin industrial park. There's another one in China, which is the China Guangzhou Industrial Malaysia
Industrial Park, industrial the QCMIP. Park.
Yes. At the moment, Alliance Steel is the first factory to be set up in MCKIP. There are many others that's waiting. And I think investments by Alliance Steel is about $5 billion. At the moment.
So with Alliance Steel, there's the issue of the Great Wall of China in Kuantan.
Yes. The Great Wall of China, which has already been the talk of the whole of the Malaysian people. Actually, what happened was the local council law only allows for 1.8 meter concrete wall. But they built their wall up to 2.5 meters high. And because the area is so huge, so it really looks like massive wall like the Great Wall of China. That's why it's termed the Great Wall of China. We have spoken to them and they have agreed to lower the height of the concrete wall to 1.8 meters
Is it really about the height of the wall or is it about the idea that this is...
we don't know what's happening inside?
It's representative of the opacity of Chinese investments?
I think there are many issues because initially people were not allowed in. And then we don't know what's happening. We get lots of stories about what's happening inside there. And there's a lot of also issues about, there was about the water issue, if you remember. They stole some water from, they did not really stole, but they did not go, they went against the law and then about 500,000 ringgit of water was not accounted
for. Okay, so you were quoted by the New York Times, and I'm going to quote you verbatim. We welcome foreign investments and development, but we question the huge price that we will have to pay. Who is the real beneficiary of all this financing, the Malaysians or the Chinese? I'd like you to answer your own question, if you could.
I questioned that in the beginning, and then I still don't have full answers because
who do you think it benefits more?
Initially, my impression was that it benefits China more because we didn't have Malaysia investments in China in the twin industrial park. It's all about China investing here. And how do we benefit? We were not clear about how we benefit initially, but now it is more clear now that we're government, they allow us in. And then we have asked about local people to work in the factories. Some of the issues are answered. Some of the concerns are answered, but not all.
Is this a concern that is largely within your constituency or is it being echoed at a federal level?
It is being echoed at the federal level because recently the Deputy Minister of MITI came, Ong Kiang Ming, YB Ong Kiang Ming came too, and then we went in together to discuss further about the issue. So it is not just a concern for Kuantan people.
All right. So I also would like to touch on the fact that you are in the running for the post of PKR Women's Chief. Now, you're currently Vice President of PKR.
Yeah, I was Vice President before this.
Before this. You're going up against Lembah Jaya Assemblyman Hamizah Talha for the position of PKR Women's Chief. You held that post for two terms, right?
Correct. So in the early stages.
2000 and 2007. So why are you contesting this position again?
Initially, I was not interested to contest for any positions because I believe and I feel that I'm able to do or take up any whatever that is being appointed to me. I'm ready for any appointment, position by appointment. However, there's a lot of pressure from the grassroots, and they kept coming to me, the various cabangs, the divisions. They came and then they wanted a national leader for the Wanita Wing, because now that we are government, it's very important for them to have a national leader to lead the Wanita Wing, now that Zuraida is leaving Wanita Wing. So the grassroots wanted a national leader, and then they wanted a different direction with regards to the women's wing. They wanted a model for Wanita Pakatan Harapan.
So, you know, we've spoken a lot about the factionalism within PKR. So I'd like, you know, you are seen to be within Rafizi's camp. Talk to me about what kind of PKR Rafizi envisions.
We want to the party to continue to be a party for reform. The party should continue to stand up for what we believe in with regards to the agenda for reform. The members and the divisions must serve the people at the grassroots. It is not about more people getting into positions, in the ministerial positions, or enriching certain friends, you know, for projects and so on. But the idealism of the party at the grassroots must remain, we must ensure that it remains as the agenda it was before. So that is why I am with this team.
How is that different ideologically from Azmin's camp?
I think everybody can talk about reform, but when it comes to the implementation of it, for example, if we want to appoint local councillors, who do we choose? Do we choose ones with merits, or do we choose the people in position? I mean, if you choose someone in position, they are ketua cabang, ketua wanita cabang, then they should be local councillors. I don't think that's the idea of reform that I subscribe to.
All right, we have a little bit of time left, and I do want to address some questions and comments that have come in. We have a comment here. I'm not sure, no name attached to this question or comment. So this person saying, I applaud the government for this noble effort to provide support for the marginalized group, particularly transgender. I was involved in research about this group. However, please enlighten the public about the concept of giving zakat to the LGBT group, because people misunderstood this form of support. Now, part of your mandate in this ministerial position is that you need to advance the understanding of Islam, right?
Correct.
So how do you correct some of the misconceptions when it comes to what kind of help is extended under Islam?
There is one category of asnaf that is eligible for zakat, which we call the Al-Rikab. This category of asnaf, in the past, it used to be the slaves. People who are entrapped in their position, they cannot get out of that. Slaves are eligible to receive this Al-Rikab, what they call asnaf Al-Rikab, the category for zakat. There are many categories for zakat, like fakir, miskin. And al-rikab are people who are entrapped in their position and they cannot get out of it. Today's definition, there is a fatwa by the Mufti of Selangor which says that the transgender group that are currently sex workers, working as sex workers, they are eligible under this category for as al-rikab.
What if they're not sex workers? What if they're transgender?
If they're just transgender and they're not sex workers, then and they admit they're transgender and they're trying to get back to their normal position as fitrah, then there's no issues with that. They don't need the zakat money. I mean, the zakat money is to help them to get out of their position as sex workers so that we can give them, we can empower them and we can help them with skills and so on.
Unfortunately, we have run out of time. So thank you so much for everyone who have sent in their questions and comments this morning. I've been speaking to Fuzia Saleh, Deputy Minister in the Prime Minister's Department in charge of religious affairs. I'm Melissa Idris for The Breakfast Grill. Thank you so much for being on the
show
today.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you for inviting me.
You're listening to BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U Mobile. Your passion drives our unlimited ideas.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.